What a pleasure it is to have you with us today on this Cross Defense Apologetic Show, where we look at the intellectual challenges to the Christian faith for people of all ages. Rod Zornitz are your hosts, broadcasting through the studios live of Worldwide KFUO, broadcasting the gospel of Jesus Christ for over 19 years now from their studios at the International Center of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, suburbia St. Louis, Missouri, USA. Giving a shout out and great thanks to God for the work of our underwriter, Luther Academy. Check them out, lutheracademy.com. They publish the excellent Journal of Lutheran Theology, Logia. They also have the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, 6 volumes already out and available, and a few more in the wings, as well as lectures and conferences throughout the world. If you go on that website, lutheracademy.com, they have a place you can get on their email distribution, find out what they're doing around the globe, and you can also get daily devotions. So is there evidence that our universe, the cosmos, is the work of an intelligent designer, a God, or is it through natural processes? That's the topic of today's show, the apologetic of the evidence for a divinely created universe. And to do this, we have a guest that's been on before. He's a cold case homicide detective, a speaker and author of a previous book, Cold Case Christianity, we've had on the show. He's got a new book on this called God's Crime Scene. We welcome back Jay Warner Wallace. Welcome back to Cross Defense, Jim.
And thanks for having me. So I appreciate it so much.
Yeah, I look forward to having you on the show. I enjoyed this book. And your publisher, David C. Cook Publishers, has graciously offered to give away some books here on this show. So to the first 5 people that email us at kfuo@kfuo.org with your name and mailing address, you'll get a copy of Jay Warner's new book, God's Crime Scene, and you'll enjoy it as much as I did. Jim, let's start off. I'm going to read a little bit of the beginning of the book, and then we'll have you comment on this.
Okay.
It says that you arrived on a scene of a death, and you were a new homicide detective. You said your inexperienced eyes tried to categorize this death in your own mind. It was clearly not a natural death, nor did it appear to be an accident. The location of the gunshot entry wound under Richard's chin seemed to be consistent with suicide. And Cindy had told us Richard had been discouraged about his recent cancer diagnosis. In addition, a 6-shot, .38 caliber handgun was lying on the floor. Handguns used in suicides are often discovered on the floor near the victim's body. Most importantly, I saw no evidence anyone other than Richard had been in the room. As a new detective, I suspected he had committed suicide. Be careful here, newbie. This is a homicide, said the lead detective, who was very experienced. Alan stuck out an arm to slow my entry. As usual, he made a quick assessment and proclamation, and as usual, the team responded as though Alan knew what he was talking about. Alan was unflustered. Take a look at the gunshot wound. Left side of the neck under the chin, right? But his coffee cup is on the table to his right. So are his reading glasses. This guy's right-handed, but the wound is on his left side. Shaw left the room to ask Cindy if her father was right-handed. Alan continued in professional mode. Now, look at the gun. It's on the floor to his left. How does that happen if it kicks out of his gun hand, his right hand, during the commission of a suicide? Where's the suicide note, anyway? Then there's the television. Look at the screen. It's recording a show on the DVR. Who sets up a DVR recording when he knows he's going to kill himself? I wasn't quite sold, but Alan wasn't quite through. Look at the dirt, he said, pointing to a small, octagonal bit of mud lying on the hardwood floor next to Richard's body. About the size of a grain of rice, the unusually shaped speck of mud looked out of place. Alan pointed to a second and similar speck closer to the door. Did any of you knuckleheads drag this dirt into the room? We quickly checked our shoes. No mud. Wow. Now, this got me. because you speak of how for much of your life, Jim, you believed everything observable about the universe we live in could be explained and attributed to natural physical causes and processes. So if we look at this universe as a room, all the evidence points to a lot of people to inside the room. As in the cold case that you were involved in, we just heard a little bit of it, what led you to eventually determine that the universe came about by something outside the room?
Well, a lot of it is the same kind of process that we use right at death scenes. You know, it's just asking that simple question. You know, what is the most reasonable explanation? Can I explain everything in the room by staying in the room? If I can, then it's going to be one of the other kinds of deaths that aren't criminal, you know, suicide, natural, accidental. But if I've got something in the room that really never, it can't be explained as, you know, kind of having an original source in the room, then I've got a problem. So when we saw in that scene that we've got stuff in that crime scene that we could not explain, that mud, for example, those kinds of, what if we had, let's make it a little more clear. What if we had bloody footprints leading out of the room that don't belong to our victim? Now you've got a problem. Now you can't explain stuff in the room by staying in the room. You're going to have to go outside the room for an explanation, and that's when it's reasonable to start looking for an intruder. And that's the problem we have with the scene we call the universe, is that we've got to explain, everyone has a similar kind of duty to explain, an obligation to explain all the things we see in the universe, the things that are part of our common daily experience of the universe. We've got to explain those things, and our worldview has to explain those things. Now, if as a naturalist, as somebody who believed that there was no God outside the natural realm of the universe, I would have had to try to explain the eight things I describe in this book by staying inside the room in some way. You know, I've got to explain everything by some process of space, time, matter, and the laws of physics and chemistry that govern such things. That's all you've got in the game if you're an atheist. There's no other causal force outside of some natural causal force of physics, chemistry, or matter, you know, space, time, and matter. So if you can't explain those things with those simple resources you have available inside the room, well, then you've got a good reason to look outside the room for something that transcends naturalism, that transcends the natural universe. And so that's why I think that this is an important kind of journey that every one of us, regardless of worldview, ought to go on. We ought to take a look and say, does our view of the world, does our thinking about the universe explain the stuff that's in the universe?
If you have a bias before you even are willing to look at that question that you're so rightly posing to us today, you know, to account and explain for everything in the room, which in our case today, we're talking about the universe, that's going to really prohibit your ability, as you say, to account for everything in the universe, correct?
This is a principle I actually teach in Cold Case Christianity. It's the first and most important principle of investigations. Is you have to enter the room with an open mind. You can't have your mind made up. You can't think, well, gosh, you know, I've worked 1,000 of these kinds of cases, and I get called out to suicides constantly, every kind of suicide you can imagine I've been at, you know. And so there are certain things I expect to see, and then, so if I walk in assuming that beforehand that the way the call was dispatched or the way the call has been initially described to me, this is going to be a suicide. If I walk in with that attitude, then trust me, every piece of evidence I see in the crime scene, I'm going to filter through my decision I've already made that this is a suicide. And so I'm just going to find ways to conform the evidence to my notion, to my idea. And if you do that, you know, like I always say, that, and a friend of mine, Frank Turek, we've written books on this issue, that science doesn't say anything. Scientists do. So science just is that process by which we gather facts, we gather data. But interpreting the data to determine what it tells us about processes and the way the universe really is, that's the work of scientists, evaluators. You know, the evidence doesn't tell you anything in a jury trial. Jurors tell you what the evidence infers. So here you have a set of data that you could gain through evidence, through a collection of evidence, through science, through philosophy, through all the tools that everyone uses, regardless of worldview. The only question is, what's the most reasonable inference from the evidence you've gathered? And if you're not careful, your presupposition is what's going to determine the most reasonable inference rather than the evidence. Remember, evidence doesn't say anything. Evidence evaluators, scientists, jurors, they get to tell you what it means.
that's a really fair way. And you know, I had a great seminary professor, Jim, that had a doctorate in genetics, and he also had a doctorate in theology. And he said, you know, you got to be honest, even as a Christian, and look at all the evidence and see if your plan really says that those outcomes should be there. And so that's very fair. You talk about in the book, and again, let's remind our listeners out there, you can get a copy of God's Crime Scene. We're going to give you a link right on the archive of this show, kfuo.org, the book talk page. Then you'll see the archive of this show. Or you can just search for God's Crime Scene or Jim Warner Wallace, and you'll see this one and the other show we did on cold case Christianity. The first five of you that email us with your name and mailing address will get a copy of this excellent book. Jim, you talk about here early on about four categories of evidence that we should consider about this natural room, which we call the universe. Share those and talk a little bit about those four categories, if you would.
Yeah, no problem. I think this is one of the kind of interesting issues involved in assembling cases against a particular defendant. You know, if I've got a defendant in view and all I have is one piece of evidence, I've got an eyewitness who saw the defendant at the crime scene, well, I can make a case on one piece of evidence. It's possible to do that. But an even stronger case would be built if I had different kinds of evidence that have nothing to do with one another that all point to the same reasonable inference. So if I've got, you know, somebody who saw you there, but I also have your fingerprints and DNA there. There's some physical evidence that connects you to the crime scene. There's statements you made to friends related to your involvement in the crime. There's behaviors that people saw on your part before and after the crime. Well, now I've got a bunch of different categories of evidence, different kinds of evidence that all point to the same reasonable inference. And when you see that happen in a criminal case, you're probably on good ground. And so what happens here is I look at eight pieces of evidence in the universe. I'm looking at the origin of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe. Those are two cosmological sources of evidence. Looking at the origin of life in the universe and the appearance of design and biology, those are two biological pieces of evidence. Looking at consciousness, all of us experience consciousness and free agency, the ability to make decisions freely without the prior, you know, determined physical processes. Well, that is a form of mental evidence. And then finally, we're looking at objective, transcendent moral truths and the existence of evil in our universe. We've all got to explain these things. Those are two pieces of moral evidence. So if you look at it, you've got eight pieces of evidence in four different categories. If all eight pieces in four very different categories that you evaluate in very different ways, if they all point to the same reasonable inference, you probably are standing on good ground.
So kind of looping back to the beginning, which I think is a great point to keep in our mindset when we're discussing this or thinking about it ourselves, we have to account for all the evidence in the universe and these eight you know, areas. Your explanation really has to count and take all these in. This one I really enjoyed, Jim, I got to tell you. Because, you know, we are so glued in to the origin of the universe, the beginnings. Yeah. And you talk about how a piece of small curved foam was at a crime scene. And that one, in your mind and in mine, I'll never forget that now, and I will use it a lot, helps illustrate the beginnings of the universe. Tell us about the small curved piece of foam at a crime scene that helped illustrates the origins of our universe.
Well, in every chapter of this book, what I try to do in all the books I've written is to try to start with a crime scene, start with something that's related to my professional work, then show you how this approach we took to solve this case could actually be applied to something broader. And so here we're talking about a case that was on Dateline years ago that I did from, I think, 1984. This young lady was killed in a restaurant. Maybe it was 88. But anyway, she was killed in a restaurant, and next to her body was a little piece of curved foam, and nobody could figure out, you know, what where that foam came from. We knew, though, that that was a key to the whole case. And this is always the case when you have evidence at a crime scene. One of the first things you've got to ask is, when did this piece of evidence first enter the scene? You know, when, what caused it to appear there? Because if it's something that was part of the scene, you know, it's some part of the kitchen in which she was working, well, then there's not really much value necessarily. Of course, if it's been moved or tampered with, it would be. But the point is, when did it show up? Did she bring it in as the victim, or did the suspect bring it in? And this is what happened in this case, is that the suspect happened to deposit this piece of foam. It came from his shoe when he leaned over her property to take her property after he killed her. And so you have this issue that we can actually look at. It's important for every piece of evidence, you know, one, what causes it? It's really about origination. You know, how long has it been there? Has it been there forever? Did it appear there at some point? It's going to help us. What caused it to appear there? Who caused it? What caused it to appear at the scene? And finally, what is the kind of explanation? Why did it appear in the scene? Jurors are going to want to know the answer to all three of those. And it turns out those three questions, origination, causation, explanation, those are three things we're going to have to do for every piece of evidence, and they're probably going to help us to make the case. So the same thing is true here. And what we're asking, the first question we're asking is, hey, well, the first piece of evidence we got to examine is the room in which other evidence exists, the universe itself. Where does this, what originates it? What's that cause, and what's the best explanation? And so we have to start there. And that's what we try to do in the first chapter, is because we know that all science, all the data, points to one conclusion, that we are in a universe in which everything, all space, time, and matter, you know, you might think, well, wait a minute, space isn't anything. No, yes, space is something. It's not nothing, it's something. Aristotle says nothing is the stuff that rocks think about, dream about. You know, it's nothing is nothing. So all space, time, and matter, according to the science, begins from nothing. That's a remarkable claim. It's not my claim as a theist. It's the claim of science. Now, the question, of course, is, well, okay, if all the stuff we think of as natural is space, time, matter, and the laws of physics and chemistry that govern space, time, and matter, if something other than that is the first cause of that, because, you know, you can't create yourself, so we're looking for something that's non-spatial, non-temporal, non-material. By definition, this has to be something that's extra natural, because the stuff we consider to be defining what nature is space, time, and matter. So we already begin this exploration by knowing that first cause of the universe has to be something that's outside the room. Now, what could that outside the room thing be? That's the question that physicists are pondering and trying to figure out for themselves. But remember, whatever accounts for the origin of the universe also has to account for the fine-tuning in the universe, the origin of life, the appearance and design of biology, you know, all the mental realities we experience in consciousness and free agency, all the moral evidence we have from transcendent moral truths and evil. All of these things have to be accounted for by the same suspect. So if you're going to say, for example, a multiverse generator of some sort, which is really hard to define since it cannot be spatial, temporal, or material, if this is the first thing that creates the universe, can it give you all that other stuff? That's the problem, is that you get a suspect profile when you start digging through this stuff. And as you get a suspect profile from all eight pieces of evidence, there's only one kind of first cause that could give you all that stuff, and that's the problem.
Yeah, and we're you know, kind of back to that general theme that it has to account and explain all the data and evidence in a reasonable way. And as you say, you know the suspect that for all of those eight in the cosmos has to be pretty amazing. You know what I really appreciated about this discussion in your book, Jim, is the way you unload you know, the argument, and I think it's essential, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, between, you know, it did the universe really have a beginning, or has it always been there? And so we talk about it in terms of, does it have a finite or an infinite nature? Talk to us about that a little, if you would.
Yeah, because if it has an infinite, if it's always been here, you don't have to account for it. So if I came into that death scene and I saw that piece of foam rubber sitting there, but somehow you could convince me that it's been here since the room was built, it's been here as long as this building has been here, well, then I don't need to account for it. It's not going to be related to my... I'm not going to assess it and try to ask, you know, how did it get here? It's always been here. So I can stay inside the room, you know, basically, for an answer. It's always been inside the room. I don't have to go outside the room to look for an explanation for that piece of foam if I think it's always been there. So that's kind of the claim that was made early, is that, you know, a lot of the first thinkers about the universe, even the first thinkers about physics, really presumed that our universe, that it was, has been, is eternal. It's always been here. And so you don't have to account for its beginning. But the whole history of science in this regard, it slowly, piece by piece, pointed to just the opposite. So even philosophically, evidentially, and I show the different categories of evidence that can be assembled to make the case for the existence, the beginning, a universe that has a beginning, from kind of theoretical evidence of the work of Einstein to the observational evidence we see in an expanding universe to the thermal evidence we see in the second law of thermodynamics to the amount of the quantitative evidence of the amount of helium we have in the universe, the residual evidence of the you know, kind of cosmic background radiation, and even the philosophical views related to the problem of infinite regress. Now, it would take a whole hour and a half for us to go through all those things together, but what was interesting is the science in those six areas and the philosophy in those six areas all point to the same conclusion, that the universe cannot be eternal to an infinite past. So that's the problem. So here's, and all of that, we also know from the evidence that the universe is expanding from a point in which all space, time, and matter began, and that the amount of usable energy, second law of thermodynamics, we're heading toward a heat death. So you have this universe that has a beginning, all space, time, and matter coming from nothing. And now what people find themselves trying to explain is, well, what could cause such a thing? And if something did cause this, what could its nature be? Because it cannot be spatial, temporal, or material. And then you see a lot of physicists who are either trying to redefine what nothing is, or trying to propose some kind of an environment that is in some ways natural. It's got to be natural, because these are all committed philosophical naturalists. They do not believe in God. They don't want to believe in the God in that sense. So they've got to find an explanation that is somehow natural. It's going to be caused by law rather than by deity. By law, and if you think about it, that means that there's a set of laws in place, natural laws that necessitated the beginning of this universe. There's no, like dominoes that fall, if all we are is matter, then all you have is one material event causing the next material event. In a world like that, there is no freedom of choice, free agency, because everything is purely physical, purely material. It's purely determined by prior physical material events. So, wow. I mean, the fact that you and I can argue about whether or not God exists with somebody who disagrees with us demonstrates that we're not in a universe like that, because our thoughts are free. We don't come to these decisions because they were caused by prior physical events in our brain, because if that's the case, we've never made a free decision in our entire life. We believe what we do necessarily based on prior physical events in our brain. So we know just by our own experience talking about these issues that the atheistic view of the universe cannot be true. Because a true atheist would have to admit that the universe is nothing more than space, time, and matter, which means that even our thoughts are not our own. They were caused by prior physical events outside of our control.
You know, what interests me in all of that, Jim, and I'm sure some of our listeners, is that in the way we're talking here, even if you were to suppose the explanation is the Big Bang, that chemical soup then would have to come from somewhere outside the room, outside the universe. And that creates a whole huge problem, I think, even, you know, of talking about that, which, you know, we always pose to those who put up that explanation, and they have not any answer that seems reasonable. So we're going to take our first break here. And when we come back, we're going to go into a little more depth, and I'm sure you're going to want to keep listening. And especially if you're listening and want a copy of Jim's new book, subject of today's show, God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Detective, Examined Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe, email us right now, kfuo@kfuo.org. All we need is your name and mailing address. The first five will get a copy of Jim's excellent book. Stick with us. We'll be right back here on Cross Defense. Do, do, do.
providing solid confessional Lutheran resources for pastors around the world. That's Luther Academy. Logia, the Journal of Lutheran Theology, the 13-volume Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Global Conferences for Strengthening Pastors. That's Luther Academy. Sign up for our email news and support our efforts at lutheracademy.com or call us at 260-452-2211.
We're so glad that you stick with us today on Cross Defense, because we're learning a lot about how to look at the evidence of our universe. Is it created by and did it originate from something inside it or from outside? And to help us do that, we have J. Warner Wallace. He's written a couple of books on this topic from his experience as a cold case homicide detective. Previously, non-believer in Christ and miraculously, wonderfully, graciously brought to faith. And his new book, God's Crime Scene, Examine the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe, is our topic today. And we're happy to say that three out of the five books have already taken, so a couple more left. Let's hear from you who would like a free copy of this book, God's Crime Scene. All you have to do, email KFUO at KFUO.org, your name and mailing address, and the next two will get a copy as well. Jim, when I just heard from the producer that we just got those two, so we're all done. Thank you all so much, and we thank our publisher of God's Crime Scene, David C. Cook, for providing those. Jim, when I had to rudely interrupt and go to the break, we were talking about other explanations that people come up with who try to say that it's inside the room. It's all natural processes and occurrences. Nothing outside of it could affect it. You believe that there are characteristics that help us as jurors to spot explanations when we are on juries at criminal trials. And also, in the same vein, help us spot bad explanations, alternate explanations of the creation of our universe. What are those three?
Well, I think people, this is one, something that always struck me as interesting, is that I think a lot of us are, we've kind of insulated ourselves, right, as Christians. Our friends are all Christians. Our activities are surrounded with other Christian friends. We're not maybe in an environment where we're interacting in a hostile way, or at least even in a non-hostile way with non-believers. And we don't even realize that, you know, there are other explanations for some of these things out there. And the first time either our kids in college or when our kids come home from college, we realize that somebody has offered an alternative explanation for something we believe. And they've offered it in a way that they say is supported by evidence, and they've offered it in a very emphatic way, maybe even in a hostile way against what we believe, we can be shook. Like, I mean, really, there's a way to explain that naturally? And it's because, really, we haven't even exposed ourselves to the fact that there are alternate explanations out there and how people have tried to support those alternate explanations. So I always think that one of the best things we can do for our young people is to help them understand that, look, every time I've ever done a case in front of a jury, the defense does not just listen to our case for the next, you know, 6 weeks, and at the end of it, throw up their hands and say, "Wow, that's just overwhelming. Forget it. We're done. We can't even offer a defense." No, they're going to offer a robust defense. Even though I've had cases where after we did this and we found the suspect guilty, the defendant actually confessed to the case, confessed that he was in fact the killer. And before that, his defense attorney spent 4 weeks bringing in experts, offering what he says was better explanations, trying to refute all the evidence that we had presented. So just the fact that somebody can offer an alternative does not mean the alternative is true. Does not mean the alternative is viable. So I just want our Christian friends who are listening to recognize that, you know, you're going to get some alternate explanation in just about every area that you might try to defend. You might say, well, no, I think here's a good reason to believe in God. Well, get ready. Someone's going to have a refutation for that. The question is the refutation well-grounded? There are three things, like you mentioned, that I see all the time. The first thing is just that sometimes these refutations are just not supported by the evidence, and we have to make sure the jury understands. Now, look, we've all got to explain these 10 pieces of evidence, and their alternative does not account for, say, 5 of these pieces of evidence or 6 of these pieces, whatever. And so that's the first thing I see happening. The second thing I see happening is that the defense will sometimes try to redefine either the nature of the crime, what he really meant when he said this. You know, it's always some effort to redefine. And the third thing I see is that sometimes there'll be a logical inconsistency. You know, like, well, look, would somebody actually behave this way and this way before the crime and then say this and this after the crime? Does that make sense logically if he's not involved in the crime? So those three areas, not supported by the evidence, try to redefine something unnecessarily and unreasonably, and then three, make some logical error. I see that all the time in criminal defenses, and I see the same thing in the alternatives that people try to offer for any one of these 8 pieces of evidence when they're trying to offer it from inside the room. What we have to do is be careful and look for these three areas of error, and when we see it, point it out. And that's, I think, it'll help our young people also to see why the alternative explanations don't work.
I'm glad you pointed this out, because as you highlight, especially for our younger people, sometimes when they hear there's another explanation, if it's not coming from our side saying, hey, there are explanations for all of this on the natural side, we need to be aware of them, examine them carefully, see if they support and account for all the evidence. They can be very befuddled and actually persuaded. And so to carefully look at their explanation, you know, I think I offered, just as to me, a classic example in my own head, Jim, about the only jury trial I've ever sit on, and it was for double attempted murder and double attempted kidnapping and everything else. And the defense was accounting for all of the evidence in a totally different way, as you're more aware than I. And I remember I'm sitting there and listening to all this and say, wow, this starts to sound pretty good. And then there was one little bit of evidence, critical evidence. It had to do with the gun involved in this attempted kidnapping and murder. And the defense was trying to say that the gun came from within the car where the two victims were assaulted, rather than what the prosecution was saying, that the defendant brought it on him into the car. And, you know, they offered as the explanation for where it was in cross-examination, well, it was in the door panel little holder where you put cups and all the other stuff in the new ones. And then the prosecution showed us actual pictures of the interior of that car door. It had no such place to put anything, even a napkin.
That's a great example of how, you know, when did this piece of evidence enter the scene in this car, in this case, the inside of the car? It was critical, right? Because if it started off in there, you might be able to explain it some other way. If it got brought in there, which means it most likely belonged to the suspect who brought it in there, it changes everything. So that's exactly what we're trying to do here when looking at these 8 pieces of evidence. So how do they get in the scene? How can we reasonably explain? Have they always been here? Did they emerge in the scene? If so, what are the causal factors that might most reasonably explain how they emerged in the scene? This is the kind of stuff that all of us ask, you know, that really we need to ask in order to come to good decisions.
Jim, would you say that once, as in the case of myself and the other jurors, that because I know when we deliberated, we all said that the fork in the road, which we started to take, was that when we heard that gun, you know, really in our mind, there was no evidence that it was in the car as the defense. We started to suspect the rest of the other defense story, and the more we did, we saw holes in everything. Is that true, do you think, in this universe case that we're talking about as well?
Well, I think that, you know, just because I'm always hesitant, and to be fair to both sides, I'm hesitant to say, you know, look, if the defense is wrong about one thing here, that means they're wrong about everything. Because the reality, of course, is that you could be wrong about something and still be right about everything else. Witnesses, this happens all the time. We bring a witness in, and the witness has got one detail incorrect. The question is, why might they be wrong? Now, if you suspect the reason why they're wrong is because they're lying to you, that's different. then of course you got to really look at what, because if you think that they're lying to you, then they're lying to you potentially about everything. I get that. But if they're wrong about one thing, you know, because you can, they've misinterpreted something, or I want to be fair. So I think the same is going to be true with the prosecution, right? You might, I might have, this is why we're very careful. If we've got a missing gun, for example, and we don't know how he destroyed it, we know he had 6 hours to get rid of his gun, but we're not quite sure what he did with it. I'm not going to make claims about what I think he did with it, because I don't really know. And if they think I'm wrong about that one issue, I don't want them to interpret I'm wrong about every issue. So I try to be very careful not to make claims where later on they might think I'm wrong. Same thing true is true here. I think in the end, I could be wrong. So let's say, for example, I misinterpret how difficult it is to get proteins to form from amino acids, and I'm off by a level of say 10. You know that it's 10 times easier, but you know it's just two different levels of impossible. And I either one is impossible, but I'm off by a level of 10. Well, okay, I could be incorrect about that. Doesn't mean my conclusion though about the inadequacy of naturalism to explain the formation of proteins or to explain the formation of biological organisms is incorrect. I may just be wrong about how desperately incorrect it is, right? So I think in the end, we have to be fair to each other, right? And I try to be that fair to the defense, even in that side as well, on those kinds of issues.
I thank you for that fairness. I was just really suggesting that it didn't make us disregard all of the other side, but it caused us to be more intently listening and examining and questioning the evidence that they were, or the explanation for the evidence.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think you would want that from your
sure.
Jurors. You want them to be a little more critical when they see something that doesn't seem like it jives.
In your work in cold case homicide work, Jim, you always would consider if there had been some evidence of tampering.
Yeah.
With the evidence, and of course, in a homicide, you've got dead bodies. In our case, in our room of God's universe, we have living bodies. What compelling evidence do you see out there for considering something outside our universe has intervened to make this planet such a wonderful place for living beings?
Well, I think in the end, you know, you have to always assess, you know, what are the odds, given what we have available to us, that this could occur the way it did? And what people see in the universe is rather non-controversial. You know, the appearance of fine-tuning in the universe has been observed by lots of folks, including a lot of atheists, who would say, you know, it does appear that the smallest change in any of the universal constants of gravity or any of the stuff at the atomic level in terms of weak nuclear force, strong nuclear force, if just the smallest variation in the constants was to occur, we would not only have a universe in which no life would emerge, we most likely would have no universe. I mean, everything is incredibly fine-tuned so that the universe can exist, so that the kind of planets we have in our universe exist, and our Earth can exist with the kind of life that we have on our Earth. And it's not just at one level, it's at many layers. And that was powerful for me as a detective, because I've had a couple of cases where it clearly looks like a suspect has tampered with the scene to cause a death or to cause a crime. And you could look at it, you could certainly get called out to that, and you could walk up. I had one where the house was, the woman was asphyxiated in her own house because her ex-husband had gassed her by turning out, you know, turning the pilot lights out and turning the gas up, and before long she died in the upper bedroom. And I got to tell you, when I got there, I could have easily said, "Wow, what an unfortunate set of circumstances." But I saw that at each level, you know, from the backstory, the foundational level before I even walked in the house, I could see some things that just weren't right. And then at the region of the house, the exterior doors and windows, I could see some things that weren't right. And when I finally got to her bedroom, I could see that, wow, a number of really amazing coincidences had to fall just so in order for that death to occur, or somebody could have simply tampered to make it occur. And which would have been the most? Now, if I had taken the approach that this is just the most amazing set of coincidences, I mean, you know, 30, 25, 30 different coincidences that just happened to line up perfectly to cause this, I never would have started looking for a suspect. But in the end, of course, it was his involvement that circumvented all of those, that brought all 25 of those circumstances together. Well, it turns out at the foundational, regional, and locational layers of the universe, our galaxy in that universe, and our planet inside that galaxy, are far more diverse and robust than 25. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, scientists look at this and they scratch their head. As a matter of fact, some atheists have become theists or deists just on this one issue alone, because they may not believe in Christianity, but they just can't imagine that the fine-tuning of the universe could be an accident. I actually think that these folks who hold to multiverse theories, in which they believe there are an infinite number of universes, all very different in terms of their laws and in terms of their nature, and of course, if you have an infinite number of universes, you can have one like ours, right? Where, you know, you toss the dice enough times, you'll eventually get what you want. But of course, I think there's no evidence for a multiverse, but a multiverse would at least explain the fine-tuning that everyone sees and everyone acknowledges. Of course, there's another explanation for fine-tuning, that you have a fine-tuner. A fine-tuner could actually circumvent the statistically impossible chance that we could get this kind of universe just by random chance. If you wanted to circumvent that, you could, with an intelligent agent that could fine-tune the universe to be just so, with a purpose in mind, that in the end there would be life like ours in this universe. And if that's the case, the fine-tuner overcomes all of the statistical improbabilities. And that's where I think the fine-tuning argument does lend itself toward theism rather than toward atheism.
That, you know, it helps so many of us, Jim, by providing, you know, some direct parallelism with the cold case that you worked on, as you were talking about the asphyxiation the fine tuning that we have here, sure looks like there's a fine tuner behind all that. You know, we can go on, and we're not going to have time to talk about all the great things that your book provides for us, but I'll just refer all of us to get a copy and read it and give it out to your friends. But I want to talk about something that I find very fascinating and very important, and that is that the evidence of not only of a material thinking brain, but also of consciousness. Is that an important point, and where does it fit within all this evidence?
I think this is a critically important point, and I think a lot of naturalistic philosophers and thinkers have noticed the problem of mind. That's why it's called the problem of mind. The same way I'll typically refer to the problem of evil, because we recognize there's a problem you have to explain. Well, the same thing is true of the problem of mind for naturalists. I mean, if you presume that the universe is nothing but physical, it's space, time, and matter, where does immaterial, non-material consciousness come from? We have brains, and we can explain brains in that kind of a universe, because brains are matter, you know, space, spatial. They can be weighed and measured. But are brains identical to minds, or are minds something totally different? And I offer in the book five ways that mind is different than brain. They're not the same. They'd have to be the same, though, if you're going to explain mind from the physical nature of the universe. Because remember, minds are they're not bound by physical laws. They can't be measured in the way you can measure physical things. And I go on to describe four other ways that these are different. And, of course, the problem is, how does something of this very different nature emerge from a purely physical universe? And folks have tried to sort this out, mostly philosophers, and I cite most of the work in the book, all the alternatives that have been offered for mind. But it turns out they're really, none of them work. That's why there are so many competing theories, because the theories are so weak. They've been so weak. That was telling for me. When you know you've got, you know, eight different philosophers who are arguing against each other because they see a weak spot in the other explanation, well, then, of course, it exposes that weak spot for all of us. Then, yeah, of course there's a weak spot in all eight of these, because you're committed to purely physical sciences to describe something that is not physical at all. This weird nature we have of consciousness. And does it just? There are people who actually believe, well, I can't explain it, so we just think it emerges. It just somehow it emerges from physical realities. Well, okay, that's a very kind of ugly form of magic. At least when we say that there is a divine creator who's responsible, we're not saying it just pops into existence from nothing magically. There's actually a creator who's, you know, this is far worse than our view, if you ask me, to suggest that there's no reason for this and it just emerges. And again, these explanations just don't work. So I cover all the alternatives in the book. But the problem of mind is not a problem for us, because we believe there is a vast creative mind called God that creates us in His image. So of course we're going to possess minds. We're in the image of God. And we have free agency to make free choices with our non-material minds, because again, we've been created by a mind who has the freedom to create, and creates us in His image. So again, we've got a good explanation for why we live in a universe that seems to defy purely physical laws, and because we are created by a God who defies purely physical laws.
Well said. You know, Martin Luther, he was a real stickler for the conscience, and he felt that the whole of Christianity was to have a good conscience. You know, knowing that God the Creator had given us a conscience to that would falsely accuse us, and at other times defend us. And so, you know, having sinned and then realizing that Jesus paid the price for that, it clears your conscience. So very important area for Christianity, and as you say, a problem for the other explanations of this wonderful universe that God gave us. Lastly, Jim, you know your work in cold case detective, incidences. You talk about the vital part that expert witnesses have played in your career, and also in as well in the apologetic side, which we're talking about today. Speak about the importance and the usage of expert witnesses in our case. And I thank you for your great section that you have on that. And, so I wanted to highlight that. And you talked about that previously, that, it'd be great if our people get some of these and become familiar with them on both sides, because having both sides, to me, is even more convincing of our side. When you hear the other side and evaluate it, it brings conviction.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to know who's saying what out there, because in the end, we don't want to, I'm not always going to cite Christian or theistic sources to make a case, because then I really haven't looked at the other side to see what the other side is saying. So what I try to do is, if I had a certain area, I tried to buy everything that was been written in the last 5-10 years on the topic. So I ended up reading 135 books in order to write this one. And so what I try to do is source all of those. At the end of each chapter, at the very end of the book, I show you three people who have made the case for this particular piece of evidence from inside the room, and three people who make the case from outside the room. And I give you the books that they actually wrote to make their case. So that if you really want to go further, you should get those books. You can get them used on Amazon, whatever you want to do. Just get the books. Don't trust what I'm saying they're saying. Go read what they're saying they say. And it'll help you to see what kind of case they're making for staying inside the room. And then you can evaluate that case for yourself. Because at the end, I don't want, look, as a detective, it's kind of just the facts, ma'am. And you start by just gathering all these facts. Now, in the end, as a detective, I make a decision on who I think did it. And once I make that decision, I move forward with that decision in mind. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't make decisions. Of course we're going to make a decision. But you start by just gathering the facts, and you weigh those facts out. You put them on the table. You look at all, you get your friends, get a whiteboard. You start talking to your detective associates. You kind of make a case. And this is what I think we can all do with this evidence. And that's why I wanted God's crime scene to be a kind of a gateway drug. It gives you, it kind of opens up the door to these issues, but it points you to all the expert witnesses on both sides, and it tells you what they're saying. So you can kind of look for yourself and go out and get those resources.
I remember my first apologetics class in seminary, Jim. One of our assignments was read this collection of essays by the very best stuff that atheists had against the existence of God. And with a lot of trepidation, I must say, I didn't want to read it because I thought, what if the arguments are so good that I'm start to doubt?
Yeah,
and
right.
I was amazed, and we had to give reports on them. I was amazed that I could see through the very best that the other side had. But I was also impressed with the ability of these people, and I think it's the same here. So I really appreciate that you've collected on each one of the big evidential areas that we're talking about here, tampering with the evidence, the origin of life, those kind of things, the beginning. You give us an example of an explanation from the inside or the outside. So just a wonderful effort there. We're running out of time, Jim. Any closing thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Well, I think this is a responsibility that all of us have to be the first kind of defender of Christianity that your young people, your family, your kids ever talk to. So if we don't cover these issues with our young people while they're still in high school, while they're in junior high, even while they're in upper elementary, then trust me, they're going to start to develop questions and they're going to look for answers. And if you haven't been the person who's been able to give coherent thinking answers to the most important questions they're going to have, well, then get ready, because they're going to encounter somebody at the university who will do that for them, and they may not hold your worldview. So the first apologist that any young person needs to hear from is you as mom or dad. So when you get these books, I mean, I don't want you to get books and give them to your kids. I want you to get books, all of us who are writing in these areas, so that you can learn the case, so that when your students have a question, and it's first going to come up at dinner or it's going to come up in the car, wherever, you're able to answer it right then and there.
I'm so glad you said that, Jim, and we're out of time. Thanks for being a great guest and writing a great book, and hope to have you back again.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
God's Crime Scene, Cold Case Detective, Exams and Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe, here on Cross Defense. Tune in next week. The Apologetic of the Witness Mentality to Mormons, next week on Cross Defense.